Hello, world. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, the host of COVID-19 News and of Planet Waves FM. Both are located on the website planetwaves.net. You're about to hear my interview with Dr. Stephen Buston in the UK, recorded Monday, February 1st, 2021. I had originally called him to speak about the reverse transcriptase phase of the polymerase chain reaction assay that's being used to maintain the case count. As you will hear, we got into some other subjects, including the Eurosurveillance controversy over the Corman-Drosten paper. This lasts about 75 minutes. Here you
Hello.
Go. Hello.
Hi there.
Is this Stephen?
Yeah, good afternoon. Good morning. It was morning here, I guess, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, it's just struck 11 this moment.
Just 11.
Yes. Okay. So, hold on. You're coming over the public address. Monitors. Okay, turn that off. So thank you so much for helping me out with this.
That's okay.
I'm determined to understand this the whole way.
Right.
And not have any gaps in my... I mean, this is so complicated. It's so astoundingly complex that, I mean, I'm sure that I'll be, you know, learning for a while, but, you know...
Well, it isn't that complicated.
Oh, please. Please do. I mean, you know... Wash your hands before you make dinner. I mean, that's what... Don't put butter in the washing machine. I mean...
Well, it's not quite as simple as that. But the principle is actually quite straightforward. But let's discuss things and then we'll see how we get on.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of people know that the New York Times reported that 90% of these so-called PCR-confirmed cases would disappear if you drop the cycle threshold down to 30.
Yeah.
And then what the New York Times has not admitted, and I have personally tried to shake their tree a little bit, is that they admitted in 2007 that there was a 100% false positive incident at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Do you know that incident?
I don't know.
Well,
I have looked the article you referenced, the Planet Waves article. I've looked at that.
Oh, okay. So the one about Love Canal, or the Reality Check.
Mm-hmm. The Time for COVID Reality Check. Yes.
Yeah, that one. So you know, 100% false positives in 2007, no cases of pertussis, 90% false positives. How is this possible? Is what we're looking at, I think, right?
Yeah. Okay. I think we need to go back to basics. We need to get back to basics and perhaps explain to you how the whole thing works so that you can see what the problem is, because the technique itself is not the problem. It is the way it is being executed.
Yep.
So, first of all, the thing to remember is there are two kinds of results. One is simply a qualitative result. Is it there? Is it not there?
Right.
And a lot of pathogen detection is based on yes or no answer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's absolutely no problem with that, because things like RNA quality and how much or how little is there doesn't matter quite so much if you're just trying to see whether it is there or not. Mm-hmm. But that's the first question, thing about qualitative PCR.
Was that Carrie Mullis's really invention?
The
original invention?
Well, Carrie Mullis's invention used to be run on gels.
Mm.
So you used to do your amplification in a tube, and then run this out on a gel which was made up of kind of agarose, and then look at it. So you saw bands on gels.
Mm-hmm.
That's the original PCR.
Mm.
Okay? But I call legacy PCR.
Mm.
Now, the problem with that PCR is that it is very, very likely to contaminate all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because you pick up your sample after it has been amplified, and then you get aerosols generated. And so, from a diagnostic point of view, that's a complete and utter no-no. So, back in the 1990s, something called real-time PCR was invented. And the real-time PCR and the original PCR are exactly the same thing, except that rather than opening a tube and running a gel, you detect the amplification during the process itself, and you never have to open the tube. so you don't get this problem of, or you minimize the problem of contamination.
Ah.
But that's the key difference between those two methods.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, regardless of which method of PCR you use, it is essential that you have, and we're using reverse transcription PCR, which is for SARS-CoV-2, it is essential you have two controls, always two controls. One is a sample that has no template, the so-called no template negative control. Mm-hmm. And that always has to be negative. If it is positive, then you know you've got contamination.
Mm.
And the second type of control you have is a sample that contains your DNA or your RNA, but it, you don't reverse transcribe it, so you just do a PCR.
Mm-hmm.
And that should also be negative. Now, that can be positive, but at a very, very high level, because TAC polymerase does replicate RNA, if only very inefficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem, of course, that can arise is if you have contamination and it's very low-level contamination, then you can get something at the very end of your run. But we can get onto that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
So from a qualitative point of view, for most pathogen detection, if you run your PCR in an instrument and you get a negative result, your controls are negative, your positive control is positive, you're happy with that result. Now, what can happen is that you get a result that is at the borderline of detection, and that is anything about, well, okay, let's go back another step. Now, the way real-time PCR is, The output of a real-time PCR experiment is the quantification cycle, the CQ cycle.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the CQ cycle is that different reagents and different instruments and different operators can get significantly different CQs. So, in fact, I'm just publishing a article to describe this in more detail. And I think that I saved my paper, I can't remember. But what is well known, we've published this, we've mentioned this several times, a lot of times, that, for example, if you have a probe from two different manufacturers, then your background of the probe can be or is different, and that then can change the threshold and therefore the CQ that you get at the end.
Mm.
You can manually move the CQ, the threshold up and down and change the CQ. And different instruments give you different CQs as well. So if you run the same test with the same sample on instrument one, you get a CQ of 30, but on instrument two, that might be 35. So that is the problem with fixating on a CQ. Now, in general, if you have a single molecule and everything's working the way it should be in your lab, somewhere between 33 and 37 cycles would be the CQ that you get for a single molecule. For example, in my lab, on my instrument, I know that anything about cycle 36 is not real. Okay? So, if you run your PCR and you get a CQ of 30, that's probably positive. 37, possibly positive. And that's another issue you have to worry about, and that is inhibition. Because, of course, the detection of a single molecule at cycle 35, say, is only valid if your PCR is 100% efficient and if there's no inhibition.
What's inhibition? What's inhibition?
For example, blood stops the enzyme from working. So if you have any heme in your sample, your enzyme doesn't work as efficiently, and what you might find is that a CQ of 15 might suddenly be 25. That's called inhibition.
Okay, things that stop the reaction from working.
Yes. So that's how you can get cycles above a certain threshold that are still positive. But if you do the control, if you have the proper controls, and if you test your samples for inhibition, then you should know about that and not get it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's assume that, let me refer to my hospital, because I can give you, that's what I can tell you about, because I know about that hospital. In my hospital, they extract the RNA, and I've tested about 100 of their RNA samples, and there was no inhibition there. Okay? So I know from their samples that if the CQ is at 35, that is very, very low levels of target in the sample. Now, again, you have to distinguish between the presence of target and the presence of viable, if you call it viable, virus. Just because you detect a fragment of RNA doesn't mean that you've got infectious virus present. Mm-hmm. And the problem here is that there are no certified standards that tell us what the CQ actually means in a particular experiment. And if you look at my paper that I published in Scientific Reports, we've tried to put in a standard that we've quantified. But that still only tells you that there are, you know, 10 copies or 10, 5 copies or 100 copies. We then need to relate that to sometimes the clinical context, to know whether that cycle threshold of 30, say, does actually mean there's infectious virus. And that has not been done yet. So all you can say at the moment with these tests is that if you take a test and you have a positive result, it is likely that you have virus present. In order to be able to say whether this is likely to be infectious, you need to take the test again a day or two after you've had the first test. Because if it really is in the early stages of infection, then you would get a decrease in your CQ. If you're at the late stage of infection, when you're no longer infectious, then it would either disappear altogether, or the CQ comes down from, say, 25 to 30 or 35. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's the qualitative aspect of it. People try and use it quantitatively, particularly to discuss viral load, and you just cannot do that at the moment. We have no idea what a CQ means in terms of viral load. And then we can't extrapolate from that into a clinical context, i.e. whether this person is infected or not. But in terms of detecting the presence of viral target, the test is absolutely reliable if you include the proper controls.
And if you have a authentic target?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure why you think you wouldn't have an authentic target, because we know that SARS-CoV-2 is the agent that causes COVID-19.
How do we know? Can I ask you how we know that? Because there's so many different alleged manifestations of COVID-19.
Okay.
That you'd have to prove the connection causatively to each one, wouldn't you? Blood clotting and glass, you know, ground glass pneumonia and bad toes and.
No, well, in terms of the molecular. If you refer to Koch postulates in your article, mm-hmm. Well, we've moved on from that really, because you can't always fulfill those original postulates,
right.
Because you can get asymptomatic carriers of cholera, for example, and salmonella, and some organs just don't grow in cell-free culture. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to move on from there. And the way we've moved on from that is, if we can identify, using molecular techniques, the same pathogen or a particular pathogen in all individuals that display symptoms of a particular disease, then it is very likely that that pathogen is the causative agent. If we then isolate that agent and infect tissue cultures, and we find that the cells die or whatever, the virus starts replicating, then we know that virus is, in this case, that virus is able to infect the cells. And if we then can identify the molecular mechanism by which it does that, and we know the mechanism is the binding to the ACE2, then we have a molecular pathway for a virus to infect an individual and cause the disease. And I don't think there's any question that is happening, particularly as it's the third time it has happened. We had SARS-CoV in 2002 or 2003, then we had MERS, and now we've got COVID-2.
Right. Well,
if you find the antigen in either viral proteins and antibodies to that protein in those individuals, then there is there's virtually conclusive evidence that that virus is causing that disease.
Can we come back to this at the end?
Cool.
And because I do have questions there. So let's assume that there are authentic primers, meaning they're working from a real sample, right? That's what that means, yes. Doesn't it? That they've got a clinical sample that they know from a diseased people, and then they tell that they design that into the assay, and then they tell the PCR, go out and find it.
Yes.
Like bloodhounds having a sample of the person's hat or whatever.
Okay.
Pretty much. I mean, right? I mean, keep it simple. So let's assume that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And then we enter the RT phase, right? The next thing that happens, we're looking for RNA. We enter the RT phase.
Yes, that's the initial phase. That's the first thing you have to do. You have to convert the RNA into DNA.
Right.
And you usually do that by using a specific, in fact, using one of the PCR primers. That's what you normally do. So you have the same primer as you have for the PCR. One of the primers will bind to RNA. The other one won't.
Could you say that a different way?
Okay. RNA, as you know, is single-stranded.
Yes.
DNA is double-stranded. Mm-hmm. So for PCR, you use two primers. One binds to one strand, and the other one binds to the other strand.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
Because RNA is single-stranded, only one of the primers will bind to the RNA.
Mm. Its mirror won't bind.
Sorry? I say again?
It's mirror image. It's opposite. Won't bind.
Yeah, the one on the other strand won't bind. No. So that just floats about. So the first thing you do is you add your primers to your RNA and use reverse transcriptase to extend from one of the primers. It's called the downstream primer.
Or the south primer? Is that sometimes called the south primer?
North
and south?
I don't use those terms.
Yeah, let's use your term, the downstream primer.
I use the terms forward and reverse, the 5-1-3 prime. Yeah, but I guess it would be south, yeah. And so what happens is that primer is specific or should be specific for the target that you're looking for.
Yes.
So once you've converted the RNA into DNA, mm-hmm. you now have a single DNA strand to which the upstream primer can bind.
Mm, the other one.
Yes.
Right.
And that other strand now, and that other primer now produces a sec. Now you start your PCR reaction, and that upstream primer produces a strand of DNA from the strand of DNA that was made in response to the RNA. Are you with me?
One more time.
Okay, let's start again. Hmm. You have a single RNA strand, mm-hmm. and your downstream primer makes a strand of DNA from that.
Mm-hmm.
That strand now can be bound by the upstream primer,
yes.
Which produces a new strand of DNA that's complementary to the other strand, mm-hmm. which is, in fact, the same sequence as the RNA was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now both primers can bind to that DNA. The upstream one has already bound, and the one that produced DNA from the RNA can now bind to the newly synthesized strand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you start your PCR reaction.
Is that stuff called cDNA?
Yes. The first strand you make is called copy DNA. Copy DNA, that's what it's called. Copy DNA,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it. That's what I figured from context.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of mystery in this stage. This is where everyone's telling me this is where things go wrong.
It depends. It goes wrong when you're doing quantitative PCR because the RT step is quite inefficient and quite variable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're simply looking to say whether something's there or not, then it doesn't really matter.
Right, but for SARS-CoV-2, they're using quantitative.
Well, no, they're using real-time PCR, and they shouldn't use it quantitative. They shouldn't make pronouncements based on the CQ.
Pronouncements of infection based on the CQ.
Yeah, you shouldn't be doing. Well, you can, if it's a CQ of 15 or 20, you can be. Yeah, that's a very high viral load, and you probably can say those are still infectious.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But if it's 25, 30, then it becomes unknown at this stage.
Yes. And they're all running 37 to 47.
Yeah, that's, yeah. That's not something I would recommend. I mean, to run anything above 40 cycles is pointless.
And even Fauci says above 35 is pointless.
Yes, but Ben might have said to you about different people getting different CQs. So
yes.
Your 35 could be my 30 or someone else's 40. So we have to be somewhat circumspect there.
That's right.
But yes, well, once you start getting into that realm, you have to be very, very careful. Mm-hmm.
So one thing I don't understand is the role of the probe. How would you explain what a probe is?
The two primers that are used for the PCR are very specific and amplify a what we call amplicon, a fragment of DNA. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now it is possible by, you know, pure coincidence that I designed my primer inappropriately and it also happens to amplify something else. For example, a bit of human DNA or RNA or a totally unrelated or a different SARS virus. That is just possible. Okay. Mm-hmm. And So you might end up with the wrong amplification product because your primers aren't quite specific, right? Mm-hmm. So the probe is a third oligonucleotide which binds to the amplified DNA. So it's essentially an additional level of specificity. So not only do you have to amplify, but you also have to confirm that the amplification product is the right thing, because it is virtually impossible that if you have, get the wrong amplification product, it also binds to the wrong probe, or the probe binds to that as well. Mm-hmm. So it simply tells you that what you've amplified is the right thing.
Right. Right.
So that's why all pathogen detection kits that are in FDA approved have to be probe-based. Because you can get false positives if you don't use a probe.
Okay, so what happens when you have partial annulling of probes and primers? And what is an auto dimmer D-I-M-E-R?
Auto dimmer.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the critical or the most critical, I like to compare the primers to the tires of a car. The tires of the car are crucial to keep the whole thing on the road.
Yeah.
Primers are crucial to get your PCR, keep PCR on the road. Mm-hmm. So the design of your primers, and particularly your primers, is critical. And sometimes people don't design them properly. Mm-hmm. And so what can happen is that, for example, the primer can bind to itself. So it can loop back onto itself and bind to itself. Mm. They become it can bind to its partner. If the sequence at the 3' end of one primer is complementary to the sequence of the other primer, then you can get a dimer forming. So the primer binds to itself and can amplify itself.
Ah, it's like a feedback loop.
Yeah, it kind of amplifies itself. Yeah, but you don't normally see that, or you don't see that. The effect it has, though, is that it can reduce the sensitivity of the assay, so that you may get a false negative that way.
Right.
But a properly designed test shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And for FDA approval, the manufacturers have to show the limits of detection and sensitivity and the efficiency of the assays, and you would detect that at that stage. Now, I haven't looked at, well, a lot of commercial primers, of course, aren't published. The original, on the 13th of January, Drosten and Alfred Land and so on published sequences or assays targeting SARS-CoV-2. Mm-hmm. And there was a mistake in one of those primers. I don't know if you may be aware of this. Mm-hmm. And so that can happen. I haven't looked at the sequences to see whether they bind to each other or not, but that's the kind of thing that you have to be very careful about when you're designing primers, that they don't bind to each other and that that there is no mistake in the sequence. And then you also, of course, have to show that your SARS-CoV-2 sequences, primers, don't bind to any other SARS virus.
Or any other virus. Or any other normal RNA.
Yeah, that is less likely because it is a coronavirus after all. So, but it could bind to a human coronavirus, for example. Yes, mm-hmm. that's what could happen. It's less likely to bind to measles virus, for example. But because There are human coronaviruses already. That could be a problem. But I think more likely that would bind to some bat or some other coronavirus that exists. But that's why you do your in silico designs before you actually ever get to order your oligos. And you go through the database to make sure that your primers don't bind to anything else.
That's the right programs, way to do it, yes.
Yes. And I use a program called, it's called Beacon Designer by an American company called Premier Biosoft.
Econ Designer?
And that, it's called Beacon, B-E-A-C-O-N, Beacon Designer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's by an American company called Premier Biosoft. And I've used that, you know, for 10, 15 years now. But that is, to my mind, the gold standard, which a lot of people, or a lot of companies, I would say, use. So the problem is that typically, I design lots and lots of assays, and typically I will take the assay that I get from the design and then tweak it myself.
Yes.
So assay design is one of those black arts, you know. I've looked at kits from several companies now, and, well, I guess I must say I've never looked for false positives because I don't have any other viruses. But they all perform in terms of detecting SARS-CoV-2 all reasonably the same. But you do get differences. So, for example, you might get a 2 or 3 CQ difference. So, again, coming back to what you said about CQs, if you use a test from company A, your CQ of 35 might be my CQ of 32. And then if I have a different instrument and use my thresholds differently, I could easily end up with 7 or 8 CQ differences.
Yep.
So that's why I say talking about CQs is very misleading, really. One shouldn't talk about CQs at the moment. One should say it's there or it's not there. You shouldn't say it's infectious or not. You should just say it's there or it's not there. And then come into the infectiousness depends on other things as well then that mm-hmm. you know, are outside the scope of the test itself.
Mm-hmm. And all the paperwork admits this. CDC, FDA, WHO, the lab's own technical data admits
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I think no one disagrees with that.
Well, but the New York Times calls every PCR a confirmed case.
Yeah.
That's a lie.
Well, I wouldn't. If you have a positive result, there is SARS-CoV-2 RNA in that sample. Now, how did it get there? It could be that the person has had the virus. That's one possibility. It is possible that during the collection process it became contaminated, mm-hmm. or that it became contaminated during the extraction and testing process. Mm-hmm. So those are the three kind of possibilities. It is highly unlikely at this stage, I think, of the proceedings that the test itself is at fault. It is the pre-analysis that needs to be looked at. And something could have gone wrong there.
Yeah, yeah.
I think most people agree that just because you have a positive result, you have to then relate that to the clinical symptoms or whatever to say whether this person has SARS-CoV-2 replicating SARS-CoV-2 or not.
Right. And
the only way you can really do that is by doing a second test a day later, say, or if you're lucky and the viral load is high enough, you might be able to detect using an antigen test.
But that's not being done. Every time someone gets a PCR positive, the New York Times and everybody else is calling that a confirmed case of SARS-CoV-2, yeah. of COVID. I don't understand what the confirmation is. There's no split sample. There's no retesting. There's no symptoms.
I guess it's your definition of confirmed. You confirm that there is SARS-CoV-2 RNA there. That's what I would say.
Right. But they're calling it a confirmed case of infection.
Yeah.
And then they're saying there's like 250,000 of these a day. I don't know a single person who's sick.
You don't?
I don't.
Well, we have. Our ICUs are overrun at the moment.
Mm.
And my daughter is a fifth-year medical, she's finally a medical student, and it's horrendous.
Well, I mean, I'd definitely like to see that data.
And we've got 3,500 people on ventilators. It is really bad.
Right. Can I ask one more? I want to talk about that in a second. Can I ask one question about the probes?
Yep.
A person coaching me along in this named David Bettini, an engineer biochemist in Italy, said that one of the problems is probes partially landing in the wrong place, but they still release the Tachmann fluorophores,
yeah.
And the positive signal is amplified anyway, even though in reality the relative cDNA amplicons are not duplicated.
No, that's not a problem. In all my time, I've done real-time PCR. We had the first academic instrument in the UK back in 1998, and I have never, ever had a probe partly binding to something and giving a positive signal. That just doesn't happen. If it's properly designed, it doesn't happen. Now, it is possible that if you don't design the probe properly and don't check properly that it doesn't bind to anything else, that part of the probe can bind. But it isn't really a problem. Much more of a problem is if there's a mutation in the probe. Okay, let me give you an explanation of something.
Yeah.
Have you heard of SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms? Have you heard of that term?
I have not. Maybe okay. I have. I don't remember. But let's say
okay.
No.
We are all our DNAs are very, very similar. So you and I are virtually identical from a DNA point of view. Mm-hmm. But we have a few changes that make us different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and some of these changes are quite characteristics of certain, it's not quite true, but let's say eye color. Okay,
yeah.
There's a gene that determines eye color. It's more than one, but it doesn't matter for the sake of what I'm trying to explain to you. And you and my gene are exactly the same, except for a single base that's different. Let's assume that. Okay.
Okay.
So we have a single base that is different. Are you with me still?
Yep. Yep. A single base out of how many? How many are 32 bases?
Well, let's know a single base out of 1,000 bases that make up the gene.
Okay.
Okay, that's single base. Now we can develop tests, PCR tests, where we have two probes and they will distinguish between those between a single different base, so that one probe will detect my gene and the other probe will detect your gene. And we call that SNP detection. It's called genotyping. This is typically done for all kinds of different genes. I've just designed, for example, you've heard of the new variants that have arisen, haven't you?
What is it?
The new variants that have arisen, the one that was first detected in the UK.
Yeah, I've been wondering a lot about that, yes.
Yeah. So these are single nucleotide changes that cause a different protein. Now, I've designed, other people have designed assays that detect that single change. So what I'm trying to say to you is that probes are incredibly specific.
Right.
And if they detect something that is inappropriate, then they haven't been designed properly.
And that's a variable, I would say. That puck is on the ice. That's in play, right?
It's possible, but bear in mind that you've got kits that are being used by companies that have gone through all kinds of rigorous testing procedures. I myself have looked at three other companies' tests, and I have not detected, I haven't looked for it, I guess, so I can't say any more, but I would be very surprised if the kits that I've used at the moment, but the kits I use today by reputable companies, such as Thermo Fisher or Takara or whatever, I think their probes will not detect non-specific amplicons. I would be very surprised if it is. But I can say that the test that I developed, that we've published, is completely specific.
Okay. So you've designed your own... Have you designed your own probes and primers for SARS-CoV-2?
I design all my own assays, yes. Have you seen my paper?
Which one?
In Nature Scientific Reports.
The one on SARS-CoV-2?
Yes.
I have not. Would you please send me a PDF of that? I cannot get into ResearchGate.
Yes, of course, because we've also published all the underlying data that support. So I publish everything when I publish. So it's got all the data. That paper explains to you also about CQ and also explains to you about probes. And what I found, because we found that there was a few mutations in the prime and probe sequences, and you can get permissiveness of the probe. In the case that we've looked at, the probe will detect the target, even though it is has a single base mismatch. But let me send you. I will send you those papers. I will also send you a preprint of a of an article that I've authored, which is just under review at the moment, which discusses this whole issue of CQs, and that will probably help you as well. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I will do that.
So one other thing that that Battini said is that he said, since April, it's enough to have a positive signal. This is not in your lab, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere else, everywhere else. If you add that since April, it's enough to have a positive signal on a single gene of the 9 most common targets normally used, whereas at the beginning, a simultaneous positive signal on at least 3 genes covering the entire sequence were used. Is that right?
Not quite. The initial description of the assays targeted, I think, 3 different regions of the genome, yes. My test also targets 3 different genes. I know of at least 2 companies. One is called Primer Design and the other is called Eurofin. Their assays target 2 different viral genes. Others, I don't know. Right. In fact, no, a third one, Chinese one called Sanshuo also targets 2. I think that most commercial assays target 2 genes, one in the ORF1AB and one usually N usually the N gene as well. So I think, as far as I'm aware, most, but certainly the 4 kits I'm aware of all target 2 genes.
Okay.
At least 2. I think it's important to target more than one gene, yes?
I would say.
You can get a mutation in one, and then your primer doesn't work anymore. So I think 2 is the minimum. I would be happy with 3, yes. And that's why we have 3.
So what Battini is saying is that in most of these tests being used around the world, among other problems, is they're only looking for a positive signal on one gene.
I don't think that is correct. What is correct to say, and I know that from our hospital, if they have one positive and one negative, they'll call it positive.
Oh, I'm sorry, one positive and one negative?
They call it positive.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So I think the way I would put it is that most tests do look for both targets, but if one is positive and the other is negative, you really should repeat that assay. But they don't have the time or the... I guess the manpower to do that, so they just call it positive.
Right. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, you know, my background is toxins, and I know how much care has to be taken, and that really you only trust split samples. You only trust the sample, you know, you take soil and you shake it up and you send it to 2 labs and you see what you get back from 2 unrelated labs.
Yes. There's no question that, and this has been done, you know, again, it's a criticism that you'll see the paper I sent you. About 15 years ago, a study was done here in the UK looking at influenza, and they sent the same sample to 20 different labs, and they got wildly different results.
Yep.
So that is definitely a problem.
Right.
However, I would say that, again, I do not know about the United States, but in the UK, after a lot of initial problems, I think the results we're getting back now are reasonably reliable.
Yes. The thing is that even if we don't use Koch's postulates, we can at least consider the idea that you shouldn't be able to find the pathogenic agent in 90% people who don't have any symptoms.
No, because you can get asymptomatic transmission. As you can with bacteria, you can have cholera and not have any symptoms at all. You can still harbor. Remember this Typhoid Mary in New York at the beginning of the century.
What do you make of the study that came out a couple of months ago, in, I believe in November, in Nature, that was done in Wuhan, studying 9.5 million people in Wuhan, that said they could not find asymptomatic spread? Published in Nature. So far, no issues.
I didn't see that. Send me the link and have a look at it.
Happily, I'd be happy to send that. So are you familiar with the paper by Borger et al. Called the Corman-Drosten retraction paper?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's an out of disgrace. we reviewed that paper, the call for retraction. That's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. Is it valid? Yeah, are the reasons in the call for the retraction valid reasons?
No. It's an absolute disgrace. That paper. That.
Hey there.
I don't know what happened there.
Digital's not perfect.
Yeah. I can't comment any more on that because I am part of a group of people that were sent that paper for review, and we reviewed it.
They have reviewed the retraction demand?
Yes.
And you...
For that journal, European, I can't remember what it's called, Euro something or other.
Euro Surveillance?
That's it, yeah.
Oh, so you're on your so because your surveillance was they were there's an insistence that they retract that paper for a diversity of reasons, including the lack of peer review. It only went through 48 was published 48 hours after submission.
Yeah. All I can say is that we reviewed that call for retraction and gave our opinion. And in fact, I was contacted by one of the co-authors on that paper. And I said to him, look, we've reviewed it and we've passed it back. And your surveillance said they would let you. They would give you that information. So I have no idea, but I can't really say any more about that.
That's fine.
I can say to you that though that is disgraceful, a disgraceful piece of work. That whole thing.
Okay.
There's no truth in the.
So let's the thing I'm wondering is though that everyone admits that in silica primers are being used because of a lack of clinical specimens. I don't understand that.
No,
even the CDC, even the CDC says that there's no clinical specimens, they're using a hypothetical virus.
Initially,
it's current on the website. It was current as of July. Then it was republished and.
But who's using in silico analysis?
It seems to me like Corman and Drosten admit they're using in silica. Even here's how CDC put it. Let's see if I can find this. I've got to. CDC says this is under the analytical performance limit of detection, and it's saying that since no quantified virus isolates of 2019 nCoV are currently available, and this keeps being updated, it's still current. Assays designed for detection of 2019 nCoV RNA were tested with characterized stocks of in vitro full-length transcribed of gene bank accession MN908947.2. And it seems everyone is saying that this is all in silica, as was SARS-CoV-1 was in silica.
Well, the timeline, as far as I understand it, was that on the 10th or 11th or 12th of January, the Chinese published the sequence of the isolate that they have isolated from the patients in Wuhan. And from that sequence, the original Drosten primers were designed in silico, obviously, because they had no access to any viral RNA at that stage. So the whole of the design was an in silico design that, apart from having a mistake, and I think one of the they also had redundant wobble. Okay, some of the normally you design a prime with actual sequences, A C G T E or whatever, A C G T A C and T. What they did was some of the primers had what we call wobbles, so they had more than one position possibility because they weren't quite clear about the sequence. I think that's how it worked. And that's why the first set of primers for everything but the E gene have not been used anymore because they're not very good. And the reverse primer had a mismatch that reduced the sensitivity of the RT step. So the first lot of primers were not a good set of primers, but they were the only ones they had based on the published sequence. But very quickly after that, for example, I became aware of that the end of January, and I had my primers for the published sequence in middle of February. So at that stage, all I could do was, and this is what I did, I ordered synthetic oligonucleotides that allowed me to look at the primer I had designed without having any idea how well they would work in vivo on real samples. It was only after we started getting cases in the UK and I was able to go to my local hospital and get samples of patients from the hospital that I could then confirm on real samples that my in silico designed and validated assays actually worked very well on the actual samples. So it would have been exactly the same with the Drosten primer.
Right. See,
so I have no problem with that we all, if we don't have any RNA, if you don't have access to the actual material, we have to design in silico and validate using artificial templates. That's the standard way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And then once you get the actual sample of virus or bacterium or whatever, then you can test and hope that it works on the real thing. And if you have the right sequence, it will work on the right thing. And I think that's when they found that their primers didn't work very well because there was a mistake.
But this was used to declare a pandemic. So you're saying that they were wrong? It's kind of like Einstein's experiment. He got it wrong, but he got it right with the eclipse, you know, where he's measuring the light bending around the star when it's occulted.
There was a mistake in one of the primers. That's all. But the other two sets were okay. I'm not quite sure what the problem is, because what was obvious was that the disease, this pneumonia was being caused by this virus. And this virus started cropping up in all the places where more and more people were coming down with the same symptoms. And these primers were detecting that virus. So initially they were terribly efficiently, but by March it was completely clear that, in fact, there were several kits out by then. In fact, including my own, I tested. You know, I compared my assays to ones that were being used in our local hospital. So, you know, I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that what my test and other people's tests are taking is SARS-CoV-2.
Right. So this, I mean, let's assume that's true. Then we still have an issue of 90% false positives being used for all these draconian measures to lock down civilization and make kids wear a mask when they're swimming.
Right. You see, I think this is where the problem. You're now moving on from a test result to a clinical,
social design based on them.
They're not really false positive. A false positive in PCR terms is a contamination or a misdesigned assay. So you never ever get a false positive in PCR if you have all the controls present and if your assays work properly.
But those include having your reagents correct. It includes having quality control in the lab. It includes having competent personnel. It includes...
Exactly. That's all important.
QA, QC.
If you don't have that, you can get false positives. But I think what you're probably referring to is the fact that something of a CQ of 35 or 37 is detecting something that isn't infectious. And so these people are not really... transmitting the virus. So in terms of the PCR test, they are not false positive. But in terms of the interpretation of the test, they are false positive.
Yes, that's fit. I certainly grant you this data is being radically misinterpreted and misused for political purposes, it would seem.
Well, that I can't comment on at all.
I understand why. I understand why.
I don't even think political. All I can say is that from a PCR point of view, they are real. From an interpretation point of view, they're open for discussion.
But how can you call somebody who shows up with positive at 40 cycles, who has mm-hmm. no symptoms whatsoever, a confirmed case of an infectious disease?
Yeah. I think there are two possibilities, as I said earlier. He could be about to develop the disease. So if you test him 2 days later, he might have a sore throat and his CQ now is 25. Or he had it last week. And the disease, the virus is on its way out, and so it's no longer infectious. Certainly, at a CQ of 40, that person is not infectious. But it could be either way, couldn't it? It could be infectious in a couple of days' time.
But we're not seeing that. Really, I mean, if there's a high caseload in hospitals, that's often the case, right? The spikes we saw in 2020 were matched in previous years. It wasn't like there was some unbelievably shocking thing going on, only that never happened before and only happened in 2020.
Well, in this country and in Italy and in other countries, it has been unprecedented.
Well, but there's also the comorbidities issue, right? I mean, when you've got 94% of the deaths are people with average 2.6 comorbidities, and most of them are at life expectancy. Well, you can't really say that virus is the thing that killed them.
Well, I have several colleagues in the 30s, 40s, and 50s that came down with this disease in March, and several of them are still suffering from the after effects. One of them is a musician. She's a clarinetist and she can't play the clarinet. The other one can't go for a walk and she tires out within, 5 minutes of walking. So there's two aspects of this disease. One is the fact that it kills old and vulnerable people, however you define old and vulnerable. But the more insidious aspect of this virus is that it binds, it targets all kinds of organs. It goes to the brain, it goes to the heart, and it causes disease and what we call long COVID, where people suffer for months afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I don't think anyone can deny the fact that this is a serious, it can be a serious disease. And most people it isn't, but in a significant cohort of people, it is a serious disease.
Right. I mean, and that's, if we start from that premise, then we might want to look at Roundup and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, right? Because it's not like this kind of attention is given to all the known things that make people sick. People, they're spraying Roundup like crazy on highways now. Nobody cares about that, and people think it's wonderful to put it in their vegetable gardens.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of ways of looking at it, but I think we panicked because we weren't prepared for this. And because it was a new virus, it had just jumped into human population. It spread extremely rapidly, and because we weren't able to contain it, certainly in the UK, and if you remember, it picks from Italy, our hospitals very rapidly became overwhelmed, and that's why you have to lock down and prevent transmission, because that's the only thing that stops the virus. If you have nothing to fight it with, you have to stop transmission, and that was very successful. And what is obvious is every time you loosen the lockdown, as we did in UK is the best example. We opened up immediately. We had our eat out to help out, encourage people on holidays, and immediately it comes back. And the only thing that stops it again is the lockdown.
Right, but you can't lock down forever.
No, that's where the testing comes in. You see, what you have to do is you lock down hard. Bring the virus numbers down, and then you have to test and trace efficiently. And again, we haven't done that here. They have done that very efficiently in Korea, in Taiwan, and that's why they've got it under control there.
Right.
We haven't done that, and you haven't done that, and that's why we're the dummies. We're both as bad as each other, I think, in that respect. Except you've got the additional political aspect, which I don't understand. Why does that become a political issue?
Yeah. You mean why it's like a Democrat virus and not a Republican virus?
Yes. I mean, that's
only Democrats believe in it and Republicans don't.
Well, I think it's clear that, your political leadership has failed significantly on that.
I would say.
But, that's another issue.
And who is Tony Fauci anyway? And, why is this such a business deal? What do you think of the use of an MRA vaccine?
It's interesting, isn't it, that of the vaccines that have been produced, the mRNA vaccines are the most successful ones, and the traditional ones don't seem to be working properly. So GSK, Merck, Sanofi, the Pasteur, all those traditionally produced viruses, and even the Chinese one, are either non-effective or very low effectiveness. mRNA vaccine was always going to work. You're probably not familiar with this, but we've used mRNA for a very long time to try and do gene therapy. The problem has always been we can't target the RNA. So if you want to correct a genetic defect in a certain type of cell, you have to get the RNA into the right cell. Mm. And that's the big difficulty. We can't really do that very well. And that's why it's not been terribly effective. Mm-hmm. With pathogens, it doesn't matter. We just have to get it into any old cell. It'll produce the viral proteins, and then it'll become immunogenic. And so that's why this is working so well.
Is that really a vaccine?
Well, I don't know what you want. We use it as a vaccine. We inject it, and it raises an immunogenic response. So it is a vaccine, yes.
Okay.
It's a new kind of vaccine. It's going to revolutionize the way we do medicine, in my opinion.
Yes. Well, I mean, we're now in the uncontrolled phase of the experiment on the public, and we have to see what happens over a period of years, right?
Yes, but I think it's already clear that it's having, in Israel, it's reducing infection rates. In the UK, it's beginning to now. I think
Why did Fauci say that? Why are a lot of people saying it doesn't interrupt transmission, it only reduces symptoms?
I think we don't know that yet. Because what you can imagine that you're vaccinated, so you meet somebody who infects you, so you breathe it in and your body immediately starts responding to it, but it still might replicate in your nasal mucosa and allow you to be, you might be infectious for a day or two, even though you yourself are being protected. We do not know whether that happens or not. It looks as though it doesn't happen, but I think it will certainly, there's evidence that the Pfizer or the Moderna and the AstraZeneca vaccines prevent transmission, but I think the jury is still out on that.
Right.
Also, right. If you're naturally infected, the virus usually comes through your nose, and you have a different kind of...
Can you hear me?
They're slightly different. So it may be that a natural infection makes it less likely that you transmit in future than if you have a vaccine. But as I say, we just don't know yet about that.
Right. Right. I mean, it would seem like if there's something replicating in your nose, then like neti pot with zinc might help, like a nasal rinse with zinc. It seems like there's a lot of things besides a vaccine that have been shown to be helpful and preventive, including zinc.
But why wouldn't you want to have vaccines? Vaccines are the most easily administered and protective thing you can do. Why wouldn't you want to do that?
I would say that maybe it depends on your orientation. I mean, I personally believe that nature did a fantastic job with the immune system. We have this beautiful thing called, you know, cross-immunity, T-cell immunity, B-cell immunity, memory cell immunity, immunity of... All kinds of natural defenses the body has to help us.
You wouldn't want to vaccinate against smallpox. You wouldn't want to vaccinate against yellow fever. You wouldn't measles or polio. Vaccination is the only way to protect the population from infectious diseases. You know, Ebola, we can have the vaccine. You know, we haven't got anything against dengue. And that devastates people in Bangladesh. The only protection against developing a disease is to vaccinate against that pathogen. And I don't think you'd happily not have a polio virus, polio vaccination.
Well, okay, so my understanding of the history of polio is that it starts to become an issue when our lives became more sanitary. And when our lives became more sanitary, people were not exposed to the lesser forms of polio and developed cross-immunity. And then when – this is according to the viral theory of polio, that when our lives became more sanitary and people were not exposed to dirt and grime and all that stuff, then the more pathogenic versions of the virus could jam in.
No, that's not how things work. No, but let's take another example. Let's take smallpox. Best example. You know, smallpox was a scourge of the before Jenner found that the chickenpox was it chickenpox or no, whatever it was. He vaccinated
cowpox.
Cowpox. I think that there's no question. I think no one really should argue that vaccination isn't protective and doesn't help us fight infection and disease, particularly in poor countries where people are dying, from all kinds of different diseases, including typhoid and salmonella and God knows what else. That's my opinion. I just could not argue any different. Look at measles. Measles is a killer. Measles vaccine protects against measles.
But there's famous litigation from Germany in 2017 that is essentially proven that this virus has never been isolated and purified.
Which one?
I forget the name of the litigants, but it went to the High Constitutional Court in Germany.
But which virus?
Measles.
Yeah, of course it's been purified. We can look at pictures of measles virus.
Do you have this? Can when we correspond after this conversation, could you send me the paper showing the purification of measles?
Yeah, I'm sure I can. Email me with all the things you want me to send you now. I'll get them together, okay?
Yeah, there's not so much. There's the current paper on SARS-CoV-2.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to send you the Nature piece.
Yes, please.
On asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
You said you have something on purification of measles, maybe.
Well, I have a pick. Well, yeah. Don't forget, you may not be aware of the fact I was involved with the MMR autism trial in Washington.
What Washington State?
Washington, D.C. Back in 2007, there was a case which was held in front of the special court that we have in America.
Yes, the vaccine, the HHS Court of Claims, yes.
Yes. So I was an expert witness for the Department of Justice. In fact, it also revolved around RT-PCR, showing that... that the RT-PCR results where they were showing the presence of measles virus in the intestine of the autistic children were all false positives, all due to contamination.
Ah.
So that was my association. And from that, I know that I've got pictures of the measles virus. So I'll dig that out and send it to you.
Interesting. So one thing I'm interested in, then I have one question about Spanish flu. But the study showing purification and isolation of SARS-CoV-2, I have not seen anything that, to me, meets the standard of purification and isolation. Everything's run through other cell lines and put into a broth, and then they PCR the broth and they find their target.
And they see it. There's pictures of it.
Right, but why does every government, when public records request, including United Kingdom and the United States, say we have no clinical samples of this? Why do they all say that if it's not true?
I have no idea. I mean, that's not really my area of expertise, but as far as I know, the original samples from the first paper that was published, has all the purification, all the evidence, including electron micrographs. And the first patient that was detected in the United States, his RNA or his viral RNA forms the basis of all RNA samples then sent out by the CDC to labs in America. So it has definitely been isolated and cultured from a patient sample on numerous occasions, including in the United States.
But there's
I don't know.
There's two definitions of isolation going around, though. One is that you separate it from all else, and the other is you put it into a broth and you find it.
Yeah. Well, that's not really my area of expertise. As far as I'm concerned, I've read the papers, and that's the standard way of isolating a pathogen, so I have no problem with that.
Well, it's the current way that's used, I would say, the idea of, true purification, you separate it in a centrifuge, and you've got of only that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can, then that is the thing that is sequenced and then used to prime the PCR. It does not appear that's what's happening. From my limited, a year into this.
Well, The way the sequence was established was by taking the sample from the original patients, growing up something, and then sequencing it, and then just assembling the sequence. And what came out of that was a SARS virus, which then very closely resembled a bat SARS virus, and was obviously was a different one. So, this is a standard way of doing this. So I really don't want to comment. I can't comment any further on that, except that to me that's perfectly acceptable, and that's the way to do it.
Right. Okay.
You then want to take that virus, whatever you isolate, then infect a tissue culture. They've infected animals, haven't they? And they've become sick. So, yeah, I don't see a problem there.
Okay. I mean, I'm just. This is the first. You're the first convincing person I've heard argue that side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because nobody wants to say. You know, very few people want to say much anyway, right?
Right.
If I can bring you into that discussion with this other biochemists I'm working with who are saying, well, we've got our own earlier definition of isolation, which means separating it from everything. And all the isolation that's happened with SARS-CoV-2 has been through a process of crumbling it into a broth of other cells, an impure broth, and then finding it using qPCR.
Okay, let me go back to the original Wu paper and have a look at it again, and I'll get back to you about that as well. Okay, and I'll give you my opinion about what I'm reading, and I'm trying to lay it out for you so that both you and I understand it.
I would love that. I would be so grateful to have that. One last question. There's a August 2nd, 1919 paper from JAMA by Milton. 1919. It's 101. 100, it'll be 102 on August 2nd. Experiments determine the mode of spread of influenza. And they took a bunch of people who were sick with Spanish flu, as it was called.
Yes.
And then they took volunteers from the military and from prisons who were not sick with it. And they couldn't. And they had them breathing down into the mouth, the sick person breathing into the mouth of the healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
They were inoculating the person's nasal passages and throat with sputum from corpses and also actively infectious people. And they couldn't transmit one case of Spanish flu.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not aware of.
And the doctor. Yes. The scientist writing it. What do you consider your specialty?
I'm a molecular biologist. So my specialty is nucleic acid detection, PCR, transcriptional control, regulation, that kind of thing. I'm not a virologist. Bear that in mind.
Got it. I mean, this is why you're doing these molecular tests. This is not.
I can give you very detailed and I think convincing answers to anything to do with the PCR or with molecular technologies. As far as anything else is concerned, I can give you an informed opinion based on my experience with these things. But I'm not an expert on isolating viruses. I just know how it's done and how pathogens are being isolated and identified. But I don't do that sort of thing myself.
Right. But you accept running it through a cell culture as being a form of isolation.
Yes.
As opposed to getting clinical samples from 500 patients with the same symptoms and making sure they're all the same, for example.
Well, I think you want to do both, don't you? But what you normally do is you get the sample from the patient and then run those. Once you've identified what the pathogen is, then you can do the PCR. You can't do it beforehand.
Yeah,
that's
you
the
need
problem.
Right. You have a tautology. If you don't do it, if you don't have the isolate first, if you don't have the known pathogen first, the PCR can't be valid. It's like sending the dogs out to find a specific person without the sample of their scarf.
But what you can do is you can take the sample and sequence it. And there you don't need any sequence information. And then you simply assemble the sequence and see what comes out. And then you find that there's some pathogen that you've never seen before. And I think that's how they identify the virus. But let me go back and but bear in mind that sequencing is, PCR requires you to not have sequence information. Sequencing doesn't.
Wait, say that again, please.
PCR requires you to know what the sequence of your target is. Otherwise, you can't do PCR.
Yes, yes.
But if you want to sequence something, then you can take a sample and just blindly obtain sequences.
Yes. But how do you know which to target? There's so many things. If you cough into a tissue, how many viruses are going to be in there? How many bacteria are going to be in there?
There'll be very few. If you take a blood sample, there'll be no bacteria at all, and there really should be no viruses either. So if you take a sputum sample, there will be lots of bacteria. But then what you do is you typically, when you sequence, and that's what anyone does it like this way, you get, you know, lots and lots of sequences, and you just plunk them into a computer who compares the sequences to the database and then comes up with it assembles your sequences and tells you what's there. So most of your sequences will be human DNA, and then there'll be the odd bacterium if it's saliva, or there'll be lots of different bacteria, but not necessarily any viruses. There could be the odd virus, I guess, but as something that's known. But suddenly what creeps up is something that you've never seen before, a coronavirus that whose sequence has not been published, and then you know you've got something new. In this case, coronavirus could be something else. You know, so you do not need to have a purified sample to be able to identify a pathogen.
Okay. But you might need it to test on other beings, right? On animals. Like, how do you know inoculating your test animal with if you don't have a purified isolate?
Of course. So once you know that there's something in your sample, then you would try and isolate it, yes. And then once you've isolated, then you would sequence it again or PCR it up to make sure it's the thing that you think it is. And then you would take that purified sample and administer it to whatever, yes, animals.
Right.
So, and remember, they were, I'm not sure how far they ever got with this, but they were going to do some challenge trials with the vaccine. Do you remember back in November or
yes,
so?
Yes.
Which was going to take the virus and inoculate healthy people or infect. I do not know whether that ever happened or not.
Well, I'm going to add that to my list of follow-up things.
Yeah. See, that would be the obvious, the proof that if you take 100 people and give the virus to those 100 people and with and without a vaccine, and the 100 people that have got the virus get it and the ones that don't, then it's clear that A, the virus causes the symptoms, and B, that the vaccine protects you from it. And I thought that was going to be done, but then there was some ethical... I mean, I think it's unethical to do that, but, you know, I don't know what the ethics were in the end, so I can't give you
well,
more
here
information.
Well, here in 1919, I'll read you the last paragraph of this paper. Mm-hmm. Dr. McCoy and Ritchie, doctors, did a similar series of experiments on Goat Island in San Francisco and mm-hmm. used volunteers, so far as known, had not been exposed to the outbreak at all and who had negative results. That is, they were unable to reproduce the disease when they exposed them to sick people. Perhaps there are factors or a factor in the transmission of influenza that we do not know. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we enter the outbreak with a notion that we knew the cause of the disease and were quite sure how it was transmitted from person to person. Perhaps mm-hmm. if we learned anything, it is that we are not quite sure what we know about the disease. Period. End of paper.
Yeah. I mean, I really can't give you any more clarity on that, but I know that about 20 years ago, they unearthed in a cemetery in the permafrost in Iceland, or Norway, that's in Spitsbergen, that's where it was, where there had been an outbreak of Spanish flu, and they identified the actual isolate, the viral isolate, the influenza isolate from those frozen corpses.
Where was this?
Spitsbergen, in Norway.
Yeah.
Ah. So they did find influenza virus in these people that had died at the time of the influenza Spanish flu.
Oh, that's interesting. So, well, I'm sure the homeopaths will be glad of that because they only have 200C of that virus because there's the samples are so distant into the past and perishable. Nobody froze them, you know, for a century, right? Could you keep...
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I remember because when I worked at Royal London Hospital, our virologist was involved with that project. So
that is exciting. Does anyone know the name of that paper?
Yeah, I'll try and find it for you. I'm trying to remember the name of the virologist. It's about 20 years ago. I will get the information to you.
But it was Norway, right? That's what you're saying? It was in Norway?
Yes, yeah, in Spitsbergen.
How do you spell the town?
It's S-P-I-T-S, Spitsbergen, B-E-R-G-E-N. It's a group of islands in Norway.
The island of Spit.
It was a mining community, yeah.
I'm kidding. Yeah. Droplets, you know, Spitsbergen. It's a spit
like
mountain.
That's it.
Okay, you know, the last thing I'm curious about, and I'll send you the statement from CDC of why it is they're saying that they have to use a mimicked clinical specimen to prime the PCR in the United States. That's the very language they use. In the absence of clinical in human specimens, we're using a mimicked human specimen.
Was this at the beginning of the epidemic?
No. Now the paper's still up on the CDC website. They updated it. In September. It was up in July. They rewrote their document. They updated it in the autumn. The same statement is in the same slightly rewritten paper, but it's the same quote.
Okay. If you send me the link, I'll have a look at it.
Happily.
I don't know why they want to mimic it. I don't know.
And this is why there's so much mistrust. I mean, and I have an obligation to report that they say that, right? I can't just pretend they're not saying that.
Sure.
And I'm glad I talked to you. And you know, you actually go and get samples yourself. I mean, that's my kind of science. You've got to go out with a shovel in your sample jar, basically.
Of course, yeah.
Go digging. That's been the approach I've taken with toxins. If the state says it's safe, okay, give me a jar and a shovel, and I'm going to go get some and send it to my lab, and then we'll talk. You know, then we'll have a real conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. Listen, thank you for that awesome writing in the 2017 paper. I'm going to print that out and hang it up in my office. It's good stuff, right? I mean, you know, you guys write like writers. You know what I'm saying? Greatly appreciate that. You're writing to be understood.
Good. That's right. I'm always trying to be understood, yes. So if you could send me the various bits that you want from me, and I'll dig them up.
Yep.
Bear in mind, I'm doing lots of other things, so I'll get you as soon as possible, okay?
You've been very generous with your time, and I'll get these to you as soon as in an hour or so.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, all the best. Take care.
Thank you so much. Bless. Bye for now.
Okay, cheers. Bye.